Welcome to the second staff reading. Thank you to Jen and Michael, to Jason and Noreen, to all the waiters. Thank you so much to everyone for coming. Welcome, and the first reader is going to be Justin Boning.
You've all made a terrible mistake. Thank you for that. Field Kabuki. I see so little these days. I think I must be alive. And yet these leaves go clattering. And yet these leaves. Please accept our sincerest apologies, they say. A blade of grass that thought it was a tree and was right. Is there another world? Is it this one? Is there another world? Is it this one? Two surgeons. It was a snowy night in March. I had little to do. So I signed myself into the ER, took a penknife from my jacket pocket, and cut into the chest of a sweet old man who was clutching his heart in the sweaty leather chair next to mine. Two surgeons, hearing the man's inhuman cries, pushed aside a pack of nurses, vaulted over a counter, and knelt beside me to hold open my incisions. I should have expected this day would come. Everyone always told me I was meant for greatness. In the corner, a girl snipped eyelashes from her baby doll. A boy creased asthma pamphlets into unflyable paper machines. Every once in a while, the doctors would dart glances at one another, as if they might be trying to say something specific like, incredible, or I haven't seen it done like this in years. I felt persecuted. I felt the need to retort. I said, fashion, gentlemen, is for those without style. The two surgeons must have sensed how furious they'd made me. They dropped their bloody instruments to the carpet, raised their gloved hands in the air, and began slowly to back away. That's when it occurred to me, I think it was then, that these two men and I had met before. Long ago, perhaps, in an age of kings, when I myself was king. They may have even been forced to attend one of my many weddings, or served me lamb while I lounged on a chaise in my silk paisley pajamas. Because back then, in that sand-strewn time, when our apathy was surpassed only by our unwillingness to change, we changed our laws as often as our laws allowed. Thank you. And next up, Noah Stetzer.
The game of catch. Let me first try something idyllic, a ball that moves between two men. They say a great player manages the thrown ball's position, steps forward, steps back, so that the ball appears to move at a constant speed, and he's in the right place at the right time. Stationary fielders rarely make the catch. So let's say we've got a father with the expected son, me standing still with my hands stretched out. But that won't work. The neuropathy has numbed my grip, and he's been dead a year now. Let me show you instead two strangers. Let me use intercept or seize, along with ways of exerting influence over one's circumstance. Reach and board in time a train. Perceive a glimpse. Discern an idea. Catch him unawares. Risk a whistle, a catchy tune to catch his eye. He's a catch. Catch his arm. Catch him off guard. I'm more of a catcher. Catch my drift. Catch you later. Catch up. Did you catch my mistake? Can't catch a break. Catch the news? Guys have been catching something. There are worse things you can catch. Don't let it catch you with your pants down. You'll catch your death. Who's catching what? What are we catching? What's left to catch? Catch in my voice, catch my breath. No. It's when small blue flame ignites kindling. The kind of catch that's alone in itself, the thing one avoids. A snag or a hitch, a trick you don't see. Catch, not a ball from the far side at all. Never the both of us standing on the grass in a yard. Catch, not a net full of anything you'd want. Not catch, he's quite a catch, but catch, he's got it. And now catch, so do I. Catch, where the catch is out there, unexpected, inevitable, and standing still or not, headed right for you. A body contracting infection, wood catching fire. Thank you. Up next, we have Jason Lamb.
The fog rose out of the sea, resembling ghastly figures. They floated above the rocky shore, their fingertips stretching down, then pulled away as if scared of making a connection. It was early morning, and the sun rose slowly over the horizon, the ocean calm and serene after the night's rest. My sister and I were up at dawn, milking the goats and carrying water from the well. It was quiet then, and dark, yet our senses adjusted to the rhythm of the grass against our thighs, and the rolling of the waves over the island's pebble beaches. It was a short walk from our cottage to the well, and I led the way, my sister following. She was a few years younger than I, with round eyes and soft cheekbones, as if the smoothness of her skin had been polished by the ocean's waves. When walking amongst the scattered cottages, the island's inhabitants would bend down to kiss her cheek or place their hands gently upon her golden hair. She smiled in return, always loved, and because so, loved back. She had no tolerance for outdoor activities. She complained that the grass made her legs itch and whined if pulling the bucket up from the well caused red marks on her hands. While Abigail helped milk the goats, I carried the full buckets back to the house, the veins in my arms pulsating through my skin. Abigail would run behind me, trying desperately to keep up. I kept my focus, never looking back. That morning, as we approached the well, our eyes adjusted to the dimness, slowly turning it into familiar, shadowy shapes through which we walked. Abigail was quiet, a pleasant change from her constant nagging. Perhaps it was the mist, for I moved slower than usual myself, my mind drifting, thoughts swallowed in the haze of morning. I heard a yelp behind me. I stopped to look, but halted, my neck half turned. For a few seconds, there was nothing. Then I heard a voice, soft and hoarse, as if choking on ash. Ben? I didn't answer. Ben. I bent down and plucked a piece of grass from the earth, stuck it between my teeth. Ben, please. I smiled casually, took the blade of grass from my mouth, and turned. Abigail was sitting on the path, one knee angled so that her calf lay perpendicular to her chest, the other leg stretched out before her, slightly bent, where a trickle of blood ran down the side of her scraped knee. She had been crying, but it was the blood that struck me. I watched it coagulate on her skin. I licked my lips. Ben, help me. I hesitated, then enveloped her small hand in mine and pulled her up. She lowered her hand and bent to pick out the clumps of wet grass matted to her wound. She flicked the bloody grass onto the edge of the path and wiped her fingers on the side of her skirt, creating smudged red fingerprints on the white cloth. She told me she wanted to return home. I shook my head and began to turn around, then noticed one small blade of grass still stuck to her knee. You missed one, I said, and plucked it from the wound. When I turned around, I placed it in my mouth. I sucked greedily, curious that despite our differences, our blood tasted the same. Thank you. Next up, Connor Burke.
How he bled the body. This time, when he began to pull ahead, a rope tied fast to the chromy hitch at the truck's rear end, its length looped over a board he'd lain across the garage door's running frame, its farther end lashed through the deer's rear hocks. When the weight of the carcass that in the field he'd split and gutted transferred up onto this homemade rig, though he'd done it many times before, and more in recent years because his body could not do all once he'd counted on as its essential capabilities. The frame this time pulled suddenly free from its anchor at the wall, and all of it, the deer, the board, the rope, the running frame, all of it came crashing down. And then, although the meal my mother'd made was done, and though my father was by this time completely starved, and you must know is not the kind of man who can think at all without a stomach full of food, he quickly changed and leapt again into his truck and raced the 3 miles up the road before the hardware store could close. You see, he wanted to set it right. And how can one lay blame atop such basic want? But of course, in all that rush, he forgot the rope, its one end still snugly wrapped around the hitch, the other to the deer, and so the body traveled with him through that black November dark. Think of it, what he felt when he again emerged and saw the shadowed, silent shape lying still there behind the truck, in spots its fur now burned right down to flesh. Think of how, as we like to say, it dawned on him just what he'd done or all he'd failed to do. And think what thought passed through the minds of all the others out that night when they saw that body dragging wild behind the truck careening past them down the road, or when they watched the lump swing wide inside the orange glow beneath the intersection's stoplights as he made a turn. They must have thought this man insane, just as I did when first he sheepishly laid out the tale. But thinking of it now, the way my father must have laid open the bed and, exhausted, lifted up that deer's dead weight again into the truck, I can't help but feel that I am him, or one day soon will be, though I can't guess now just what cargo I will fail to load up right or what I will forgetful leave leashed to the back of whatever carries me through a night dark as the lightless space between my ribs towards some destination lit up white, believing everything I need will soon appear just beyond this corner, is just there, waiting on its shelf, placed by the careful hand, quiet in its drawer. Thank you. Please welcome Jamel Brinkley.
Rhonda, there's got to be another way back in, the man said. Don't you remember a way? Lots of things, Rhonda said. I try not to remember. The man sat on the ground beside her, leaning his shoulders back against the locked door of the church. I didn't even say anything, he said, about what we did. I was going to tell everyone, but I didn't tell a soul. Rhonda listened with half an ear as he talked about a day years past that had meant something to him. She had long ago decided it wasn't worth it to pay much attention. The world was too awful. What you loved, family, friends, notions of yourself, you would lose. And what caused you pain would hurt all the more if you gave it any space in your mind. But you did, the man said. You told. It was terrifying to hear about things she might have done. Terrifying, though she was resigned to being coldly observed, to think she was still looked at but never seen, but not as herself, interchangeable, but always under judgment. She looked up at the greenish sky. Against her will, it dragged her back to when she was a girl, walking to school. On the way, she always passed the squat building that contained the management office. The white sign out front read, "Welcome to Patterson Houses, a wonderful community." And below that, in smaller letters, "New York City Housing Authority." An image of the high rises appeared among the words, an eerie green silhouette that recalled the way things looked through military binoculars in films. Rhonda hated this sign, the way it lied to the community, mocking it. She felt it mocking her. She especially hated the word authority. When kneeling at the church, she had tried to believe fully in what the priest had called the highest authority. She had tried then, as she did now, to rid her deepest imaginings of the green silhouette that stood and threw down its shadow, looming. The man leaned at an extreme angle now, his shoulders pressed against the door, as though attempting to fall backwards into a lake of old feelings, ready to be immersed in them. "You told," he repeated. Something had made her come back to this place, a place where she had suffered, something that felt out of her control, as though some bird instinct, bits of mineral lodged in her skull, had guided her here and told her it was time to return. The man looked up at the sky and remarked on it. He tightened his dark hands into fists and released them. Men like this, with powerful hands, were familiar to her, with hands that they used to break and tear, to take what they wanted and go where they wanted, to make other people feel small. Such men intended to humiliate her, to diminish her so radically she'd be just a tiny thing. A bit of dirty wax they could roll between thumb and forefinger and then flick away. She sensed that this man once had tried too. "Tell me why," he said. "Why did you tell people what we did?" He was still looking up. "Answer me, please." Again, Rhonda didn't reply. The man sitting next to her had been a boy she once knew. If she tried, she could remember his name. But she didn't. She wouldn't. She refused to. When it became clear she wouldn't answer his question, he began talking again, repeating himself endlessly, repeating his pleas. She stared at the line of parked cars across the street and then raised her face to the breeze. The air tasted like rain that was far away, but approaching. She raised her head higher and higher still until it was angled the same way as his. He kept going on about his memories, piece by piece building a wall out of them he could shelter himself in. His words piled on in a strange rhythm. "So be it," she thought. "So be it." She paid attention, just for a while, listening to the man who had been a boy as he went on about some distant day, a weightless speck of time. She reached through a gap that had yet to be closed off by the past, and for a moment interlocked her fingers with his. Thank you. Up next, please welcome Sarah Burnett.
Ethnic arithmetic. Again, I check ethnicity boxes, as if I could measure with a stick figure to derive the crude dimensions I'd wanted to keep separate as black beans and rice, never together. My mother sighing, it's how a true Cuban eats them. Her quick smile betraying, some part of me quiet, another confused, as though, like her, with a doll and suitcase forever in hand. She rubs the white of her forearm with two fingers, a gesture I've learned conveys superiority that says, look at me, I belong, here, not there. Check guilt, shame, denial. Check every cliche. Write fractions half and half next to squares. A type of equation. Devise an algorithm of my identity. Those parts, moros y cristianos, nunca congrí, never together. But you don't have any accent. Who am I to know who I am, sliding back and forth invisibly? And because of this, and maybe only this, which feature to cover or show? As if a distinctive mark, a curl of tongue, a darker jaundiced eye, check what's fair, what's not, I know exists to erase me. Again, I check ethnicity boxes, write fractions half and half next to squares, as if I could measure with a stick figure a type of equation, devise an algorithm to derive the crude dimensions I'd wanted of my identity. Those parts to keep separate as black beans and rice, moros y cristianos, nunca congrí, never together. My mother sighing, it's how a true Cuban eats them. But you don't have any accent. Her quick smile betraying, who am I to know who I am? Some part of me quiet, another confused, as though sliding back and forth invisibly like her, with a doll and suitcase forever in hand. And because of this, and maybe only this, she rubs the white of her forearm with two fingers. Which feature to cover or show? A gesture I've learned conveys superiority, as if a distinctive mark that says, look at me, I belong. A curl of tongue, a darker jaundiced eye, here, not there. Check guilt, shame, denial. Check what's fair, what's not. Check every cliche I know exists to erase me. Theory of probability. If the refrigerator hadn't broken, if the train had come on time, if it had been snowing harder and slick ice paved the black lacquered road, if the loud drunk crowd pushed us down, if I hadn't gone for a walk while the window was unlocked, I count it a blessing. Like that day I booked the wrong airport and you, without hesitation, picked me up. The days it could have been are cataloged in the mind. Tomorrow's as unreadable as now. What was perceived as disaster wears a patinated glaze of grace, like seeing your reflection at the bottom of a glistening cup you drank from. How else to explain that if we didn't see it coming, it was there all along? Probably there, in the doldrum hum of the fridge and the train's faulty engine throttle, there in the garbled murmurs of passengers, in the falling quiet of snow. Please welcome Leah Bailey.
Rapture, Arizona. We cannot bash heads. We cannot drive the vans. We cannot pour water freely from the hoses as they do in the books we read again and again. We cannot let a scraped knee stay dirty or it turns the whole leg rotten. We cannot leave the littles too long on their own, or they scream so hard it's impossible to get them to stop. We cannot cross the fences or leave through the front gate. We cannot sleep boys and girls together in a dome. We can trap baby birds, but we cannot trap each other and keep each other prisoner, even if it's just a game. Otherwise, we can do whatever we want, anything in the world. We can fight with sticks or knives or fire. We can draw blood, but just a little. We can eat all the food or we can choose to share. We can make rules and break rules and decide who is leader and then change our minds right away. We can snare and entrap smaller creatures and keep them prisoner all day and all night. They are fed other creatures smaller than themselves. We dangle them by their tails for a long time before we drop them in. It is a game for some of us, a cruel game we know we should not do, but we do again and again. We can go naked, but no one ever would. Here the sun scorches us all day long. The wind roars at dusk, a handful of dust in your mouth. The morning is right, but it's hard for the olders to wake up in time to wash the littles and fetch the food. Much of it's gone by the time we leave the covers. So we miss the blue air, and we're hungry. And then the hot comes strong. We try hard to make shade. Many hours of the day, that's our game. We build very well. We can craft from sticks and cloths all kinds of forts that can last many weeks, but we cannot sleep in the forts. The domes protect us from the hunting creatures, and they keep the covers free of dust. Once, we found three small terrier puppies in a greasy box under the south fence. We hid them for a while. We offered bread and honey, oranges, goat's milk and cheese and yogurt, but they wouldn't eat, not for anything in the world. And they cried with tiny screams as sharp as their teeth. Soon, someone came to take them. We never got to see them grow. We make a small school for the littles, but there are teachers for us, too. They are always coming and coming and then leaving. They have all the ideas in the world, but we don't have to listen. We don't have to follow them around on walks. We don't have to snuggle up to them to hear them read, even when they're just reciting books we've read many times ourselves. But we do. We crowd them. The littles hang off their wrists and cry when they leave. But we have seen so many come and go. How can we cry? How can we be so dumb as to stand at the fence and watch their fans drive away, spitting dirt in our eyes? What did they give us? Stories about castles, about lakes, pictures of the cities, new instruments to hang on the school wall, posters to line the domes, sweets with crinkly plastic wrappers we can glue to sheets of paper to make a forest of flowers. The words to a song we will hear years later and be surprised by the sudden fear in our hearts that the song, like the teachers, will go away and we'll never know exactly how it was supposed to be sung. Some of us go away too. When we turn 16 and can return to the adults, when we try to cross the fence and are caught, when a cut has gone too deep and we need stitches, when a girl and boy have snuck into the school after dark, when an eye is lost or a finger, when a little is left too long in the sun and their skin erupts in blisters and they can't even lie down without shrieking, when a mom or dad actually misses one of us and finally scoops us into a van and drives away. Until then, we live the very best life in the world. We've got fires at night and woody little oranges and blue mornings when we have thrown off the covers and pushed into the dawn to eat all the breakfast and leave the others to wake in the scorch. We've got creatures to feed and care for. We've got all kinds of supplies to cut and saw and drape and pin. We've got all day long, every day, to try our very best to make shade. Our final reader this evening is Stephen Kleinman.
Bear. It wasn't hard getting him to behave. They brought him in from the cold, and already he was thankful. When they starved him, he imagined he didn't need food, and when they ignored him, he knew somewhere someone else required their attention. In the evenings, he lay by their feet learning their rules. He crawled under the bed when they yelled, assuming it was his mistake. He was such a stupid bear. When they poked at him, he assumed it was the oddness of his flabby body, his oversized muscles, the thickness of his hair bunched and caked with blood, spit from cleaning himself, locks where he couldn't, that he should be ashamed of. He was so ashamed. He had a hard time making sense when they shaved him, sent him out on stage, but he knew they had their reasons. When they turned off the house lights so he couldn't see the gathered crowd, he started to roar, knowing he could be the monster they had come to see. He thought, I should always be the show. He learned to dance, he learned to twirl, to know instinctively what was around him without looking. He learned to never ask questions, but when they asked him, he could lie down. He could stand and straighten his back. He could look happy or almost human. When they brought in another bear, he became sad beyond any sadness he had felt in years. When he got old, when his muscles tired, when they needed his warmth, he let them take a knife to him. Make it slow, he said, becoming their new skin. He licked at their necks. He lay peacefully over them, keeping them warm. Ceased. It wasn't a big deal when everything stopped existing because it had all stopped existing anyway some time ago. Some people were in love with the idea of ceasing, like, for example, my mother who sang it like a song, I ceased to exist years ago to my children. Others were worried about animals and would mark on their calendars in red ink how many species ceased that day. In the moment right before everything ceased, we were on the telephone and snow was falling outside the window. I was at the cafe. There were students everywhere, but only one in particular caught my attention, a young woman on her phone, a blue computer sitting on the table in front of her. She was wearing a pink sweater, her dark hair in one chunk over her shoulder. She too had ceased, just sat there looking forward as the movements of her body slowed. This was one of the ways in which the world ends. For a minute, there was an obstruction, I forget, maybe a wall fell. The winds picked up, and suddenly there was nothing to keep the outside outside anymore, nor anything to keep the insides from falling out. I tried to look up, but there was an obstruction there too, so I said to my mother's presence, I'm sorry, I have to go now. And I hung up the phone. What else was there to do? Thank you.